Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Researcher in this area who he was a night person, a serious night person, and his wife was a serious morning person. And he used to say they used to meet for breakfast. I mean, sexual relations, obviously the social factors are important as to what time you can do it. It tends to be a maximum of roughly about 11, 12 o'clock at night, but that's normally because that's when people go to bed. The best time probably is relatively early in the morning in terms of your rhythmic activity, but there's all sorts of reasons. People got to go to work and all that sort of thing. But yes, if you've got a morning person who's married to a night person and they're got very, very different, if you like, time schedules, that can be quite tricky to manage.
What is the impact of jet lag and night work on psychological and physical health? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the mysterious world of the body clock with author, biologist and broadcaster, Dr. Leon Kreisman, whose latest book, Circadian Rhythms, has just been published by Oxford University Press, and ask whether the modern world lacks clear 24-hour patterns. In Circadian Rhythms, Dr. Leon Kreisman argues, life is a continual battle to stay in a non-equilibrium energy state. Being forced to live against one's circadian clock has metabolic consequences. So what are circadian rhythms? How important is meal timing on the circadian network? And what are their impact on disorders such as schizophrenia, insomnia and obesity?
Hello, my name's Leon Kreisman. About 20 years ago, I wrote a book called The 24-Hour Society, which was all about the way in which we were extending our time, working later into the night and blurring the distinction between weekdays and weekends. In it, I wrote a chapter about the effect it had on our biology if you work later, work nights, did shift work. And in order to help me do that, I contacted somebody called Russell Foster, who was then at Imperial College, and he helped me write that chapter. Since then, Russell and I, and he's now a professor at Oxford in what's grandly called circadian neuroscience, have written three books. One was called Rhythms of Life, which was again about circadian rhythms. One was called Seasons of Life, which was about the seasonal changes that occur in plants and animals each year. And we've just done something called A Very Short Introduction to Circadian Rhythms, which is a quick but quite comprehensive insight into what's going on into circadian rhythm research and how it's affecting sleep patterns, metabolism, and particularly mental health issues in people. That's the sort of new area that the research is going into.
Really well done on the book, Leon. It's a fascinating read, I have to say. I learned so much. I didn't realise just how ignorant I was on these topics. And circadian rhythms, it seems, pervade every aspect of life and every living thing. So hats off to you for putting together such a comprehensive, as you say, and detailed book. I might start off with a big wide open question, if that's okay. Is science all about perseverance? And will in that a little bit of optimism too?
As an awful lot of perseverance, years and years of it usually, before they can actually come up with substantial discoveries that are affecting the way the world works. Occasionally, very occasionally, somebody does something and it works first time and it's brilliant and they get all the plaudits. But that's very, very occasional. It's a bit like some of the criticisms of some operas. You know, some wonderful moments of music and singing and an awful lot of boredom in between. That's really what science is like. Every day, flogging away at the laboratory bench, trying to make sure that this is right and that is right and changing that reagent and slightly adjusting one of the dials and things like that. And that goes on for a very long time before they actually come up with results.
To what extent, Leon, is a 24/7 economy in conflict with our basic biology? And what I mean by that is that how we're living these days in these such fast-paced, long days that we've almost lost touch with our sense of inner time.
Yes, you must recall that it's only in the last 100-odd years or so that we've really switched from being agricultural people. Most people spent most of their lives outdoors. What happened, of course, was the Industrial Revolution, and they all started to move into factories, which were quite dark and dingy. About 120-odd years ago, they did the electric lamp, which looks bright to us. But actually, if you were to go outside on a bright, sunny day, as it is here in London, for example, you're looking at a light level getting on for probably 1,000 times more than it is inside in the house that I live in. That's the sort of difference. That's how strong the external light signal was. And we've, to a large extent, given that up. There are people, older people in particular, who don't go out much, who might, if they're lucky, get an hour or two's exposure to sunlight a week. The rest of us may well start work, go to work in the dark, come home when it's already dark, and not really see much sunlight except perhaps at weekends. And the problem is that sunlight is the single most important factor in regulating our daily lives. Because if you think about it, one of the fundamental aspects of the world we live in is that every day the Earth rotates on its axis. It now takes nearly 24 hours, give or take a couple of minutes. And that means that every day we have a day and we have a night. We have a dawn and we have a dusk. And that's an incredibly strong signal. Living organisms, not humans, but since life began, there's probably been a trillion dawns and dusks. And that's a signal, because with the day and the night comes changes, obviously, in light levels. It's dark. Changes in temperature, changes in rainfall, and they're all predictable. They all happen, and they keep repeating day after day, year after year. And that has an important effect on living organisms. And it's particularly true now with human organisms, because we're not meant to be night workers. We're day people. So if we work night and work continually at night, our body rhythms, our basic rhythms, never adjust. So what happens is that we're trying to sleep in the day when all the body activities are trying to keep us alert, and work in the night when actually our body is telling us, go to sleep, go to sleep. So that's the basic problem that's now starting to manifest itself in all sorts of physical conditions and mental conditions.
So what we call human progress is really shooting us in the foot, because it's really interfering with our natural mojo when you think about it.
Yeah, we're not managing the process. This is the problem. You can do things. You can have shift work schedules that are more amenable to the body rhythms than just doing, you know, a week of days, a week of nights, a week of days, a week of nights sort of thing, which are really quite destructive. We can do all sorts of things. And as long as people know and understand, they can minimize the damage that's being done and ameliorate the damage. But at the moment, we're not managing it at all. I mean, most broadcast organizations, like, for example, your own radio, a 24-hour news operation in it, they do very little for the staff to actually help them. So, for example, we're not meant to digest fatty foods during the night. So one thing you don't want to do if you're working nights is to eat fried foods. You want to eat really, really light foods. But people have to know that before they can do anything about it. And all organizations are really bad at trying to do this. And particularly, you know, the process industries where they're working all the time, steel industry, all the extractive industries, the media industries, financial services, which now tend to work a little bit round the clock, all sorts of organizations simply don't take the needs of the employees to heart. And that's the critical problem now.
You write in your introductions, Leon, that you were guided by the mantra, if you want to understand calculus, you have to show the equations. It's a very robust advice, but I'm wondering, how do you explain, I suppose, the natural body clock in reference to that?
Yeah, you're right. And one of the issues with some of the books, it's difficult to explain what's going on at the molecular level unless people have got a little bit of a biological understanding. But what we have to explain to other people, most people nowadays know what jet lag is like because, you know, a large percentage of the population have been on a long-distance flight. And when you go on a long-distance flight, your body rhythms, your internal rhythms, get out of sync with the situation you're going to. So if, for example, you fly to Australia, which is about 10 time zones distant, it actually takes your body clock about 10 days, an hour for each time zone, to get into the local time. So for about 10 days, you feel, I suppose the only word is discombobulated. It affects different people differently. Some people get quite severe lethargy. They're not functioning, their mind's not working terribly well. Others go through without too much problem. But even super fit athletes who go to the Olympic Games and might spend 6-8 hours in the air, it takes them a good fortnight to recover and to be back to their top, back to their peak. And that's what this discombobulation does. It doesn't make you immediately ill, but it does affect your performance in ways you probably don't even notice, but it is affecting you, and it can have long-term damaging effects. And what we have to try and do is get the doctors to appreciate that there's circadian rhythm dysfunctions, it can have an effect. We have to have the schools. You see, teenagers have got a body clock which is not quite that the same as those of older people. If you ask a teenager to get up at, say, 7 in the morning to get ready for school, that's the same as asking a 50-year-old to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. So that's the sort of situation. That's the effect it has. Nothing's working quite rightly if you're out of sync. Now, there are some people, obviously, who are morning people. They're much more functional in the morning, and they go to bed earlier. And there are some people who are night people who tend to go to bed later and function better at night. But the vast majority are in between. And if they're working at jobs which don't really fit their own particular body clocks, it's like square pegs in round holes. Only we're talking about time in this particular instance, and that's the issue. And as I said, it can be managed, but it has to be carefully managed. So, for example, if you looked at how we function around the 24-hour period, we're more alert at certain times than we are at others. That's obvious. We sleep at night, we're awake during the day in the main. But all sorts of other changes are going on with our hormones. The levels are increasing and decreasing. Our mental functioning is changing during the time. Our athletic performance changes. Most people, for example, are more supple, more flexible during the evening. So if you want to exercise, you really probably should do it late afternoon, evening, not first thing in the morning. Stuff like that is going on, and it covers everything, you know, what time women ovulate, what time people's digestion is working. We know these changes because during the day we get hungry. During the night, we go to sleep for 8 hours. We don't get hungry. Something's switching on and switching off. And that's a timed process going on all around the 24 hours.
And when you think, Leon, if, you know, you're a high-profile business executive who's doing a lot of foreign travel, whether you're flying through time zones or if you're a big-time sports person, you may have a very hectic schedule. So over that, you may survive that for a year or two, but it may be over 10 years. It has a huge effect on performance, doesn't it?
A huge effect. I mean, for example, long-haul jet pilots are permanently jet-lagged, and that's not good, but that's the situation that is. As you say, the business executives, some of them who try and pretend, you know, they don't change their watch, they keep the time at their home base time and go through. you know, they think that they're okay, but actually their performance, if you were to measure it, and this has been done, if you measure it, it's declined. Declines depending on how hectic and how often you're doing all this transatlantic hopping and all the rest of it. And they might end up making bad decisions. And in fact, the famous one was a man called John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State for the United States in the mid-1950s. And it was when the Egyptians wanted to build the Aswan Dam, and they were looking for finance. And the Russians were interested in financing them because it would give them an entry into Africa. And Dulles flew to Egypt. There was a military jet. There weren't even commercial jets yet. On a military jet, and he had discussions and what have you, and it all went sour. It went wrong. And he flew back, and he then decided that it was fatigue. It wasn't fatigue. He'd been jet-lagged, and that led him to make poor decisions. And after that, the Secretary of State, as he was, there was an edict went out that no U.S. foreign official could enter into negotiations or anything like that until they'd spent at least 2 days recovering from their trip.
Just wondering, Leon, how do circadian rhythms affect medical treatments? Like, for example, if I was on dialysis or if I was getting chemo or radiotherapy, presumably there would be an optimum time to take different types of medical treatment based on how our bodies function throughout the day, whether it's if we're digesting at different times of the day or our, you know, sexual peak is at another time of day. Presumably how we absorb and process different types of medical treatments changes throughout the day, does it?
Yes, I mean, a good one to talk about is cancer treatment, because what you're doing when you're trying to treat somebody with a tumour is basically target the tumour cells, which are fast dividing. And the problem is that there are ordinary body cells which are also fast dividing, such as the hair follicles or the lining of the gut, the endothelial lining. And that's why if you take the medication, chemotherapy, your hair falls out and you feel nauseous all the time. And one of the problems with cancer treatment, of course, is the side effects can be so bad that people really can't endure it. So what you really need to try and do is work out what times are the cancer cells dividing, what time are the hair follicle cells dividing, what time is the endothelial lining of the gut dividing, and try and time the dose so that you're doing it when the tumour cells are dividing, but the hair follicles and the gut lining aren't. And if you do that, you can also increase the dose that you're giving because it's not actually causing these horrible side effects. And if you do that, and if you have an individual therapy, it's called chronotherapy, a timed therapy, there are drugs that are used in this where the performance can increase by, I mean, I've checked this, it is a staggering 50%. Now, the difficulty is that that means that you've got to treat each patient individually, give them the drugs at times that are based on their needs. And hospitals tend not to work like that. They tend to work on, you know, we do the medications round at 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, and this happens at 12 or whatever, rather than when the patient actually needs it. Now, that will change as little pumps that can actually transfuse various things improve, various automatic systems come in. But it will take time. But that's true not just about cancer. As you said, all sorts of treatments could be done better if they were actually timed. For example, you take a statin. Most statins have got a short half-life. You take them at night because that's when the cholesterol enzyme that they're trying to block is most active. So we don't quite understand why we do that, but there is a reason that you should take medicines at specific times, not just once a day or whatever it is.
God, there's so many factors in it. It all becomes quite overwhelming, doesn't it? I'm just wondering about pain and pain management and how circadian rhythms affect it all. I know that I get into serious pain at night sometimes with my hip. I have a plastic hip. And some nights I can just totally lose a rag and go absolutely out of my head trying to manage it. And then, you know, it affects me at different times. So presumably that is the circadian rhythms kicking in, is it?
Well, it might be, it might not be. I mean, this is the thing. There has to be an awful lot of research now, and some of it is going in. I have a problem, not quite the same as yours, for instance, where each night, about 2 a.m, for me, I was waking up in terrible pain. Oh, you know, the real agony stuff, confess to anything, and it was in my right leg as it happened. My problem was I was having a problem with the femoral nerve. And after lying on it on my side in bed for, say, 2 hours, which is why it was about 2 o'clock each morning, that was causing the problem. So you have to try and sort out what's going on with it, because the body is an extremely complicated. What's going on in our bodies all the time? The brain's working all the time. The brain takes about 20% of a body's energy needs. So it needs glucose all the time. So during the night, of course, the glucose is coming from the breakdown of various substances. And during the day, you're eating things and digesting them to put glucose back in. And that process all has to be timed, all has to be regulated. And imagine that's going on. Every cell in the body, of which there are, you know, billions if not trillions, tiny. They're tiny, these cells. And yet, things are going on inside them in a regular, timed process. All different things. And it's all automatic, and we don't give it a moment's thought. But that's what happened. And what we therefore find that, yes, our susceptibility to pain varies during the course of the 24 hours. And, you know, if you want to go to the dentist, you're probably best going in the morning, because you can tolerate pain better during the morning than you can at other times during the day or night.
How do you explain all the problems with sleep in society today? Because if I sit down with any friend of mine, one of the things that comes up quite regularly is insomnia, and either problems with waking up constantly during the night, problems with getting to sleep, or just that feeling of being very anxious and disorientated once they hit a certain time of the night. So is that again circadian rhythms, or is that other factors at play?
Insomnia, which is incredibly common and is rising, it's not classified as a circadian rhythm sleep disorder. There are specific sleep disorders which are definitely because of circadian factors. People with dementia, for example, who tend not to sleep in a consolidated fashion, you know, they're waking up all the time, they're probably suffering from a circadian rhythm disorder, which is associated possibly with their dementia. But insomnia isn't classified as that. We don't know too much about insomnia in a way. We know that it's many, many causes, different factors. It's a neurosocial aspect. You know, if you worry about things, you don't sleep that well. But on the other hand, that's not an immediate biological thing. It's something to do with your mental processing. So insomnia doesn't classify as that, but it does fall into and is closely associated with this whole issue of sleep and circadian rhythms, because the sleep process in general is controlled by a circadian rhythm. And there's, during the day, you know, you're getting more and more tired because it's a while since you slept. And pushing against that is a circadian drive, which is keeping you alert. And these two are sort of fighting it out until you get to nighttime, when there's what's called literally a sleep gate. And that's the period of a couple of hours which opens, which is the best time to go to sleep. But I suppose the best way of describing circadian rhythms is, you know, if you miss lunch, and you normally have lunch at about 1 o'clock, say, each day, then by about 2 o'clock, you're probably feeling a bit hungry. And by 2:30, you may be feeling really quite hungry. But if you don't eat, you gradually notice that the hunger dissipates. And that's because the rhythm, the predictable rhythm that the body's got used to, got to eat about 1 o'clock, kicks in. And then it slows down, so to speak, and moves away. Now, obviously, if you went several days, you'd be really, really hungry and you'd eat whatever. It didn't matter. But that's a circadian rhythm going on. You notice the same sort of thing at night. If you don't go to sleep, you then go into sort of alert stages and can be quite alert before the fatigue gets you and you really start feeling very, very sleepy again. That's the rhythms at work. They're almost sort of counterintuitive.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm joined by author, biologist and broadcaster, Dr. Leon Kreitzman from the Nutfield Health Centre at Oxford University, whose latest publication, Circadian Rhythms, and Very Short Introduction, has just been published by Oxford University Press. I asked Leon about the importance of sunlight to health and well-being and his research into the problems of seasonal affective disorder in populations living close to the Arctic Circle.
Well, one of the big things which we are beginning to understand better is seasonal affective disorder. You know that business when some people during the winter time, they start to feel lethargic, they get a craving for carbohydrates, for sweet things in particular, they put on weight. And this affects, in one form or another, about 3% of the population in Britain, for instance, and Ireland, because you're roughly the same latitudes. About 3% actually quite badly, and up to maybe 10% who have something, a variant called like winter blues. And of course, the further north you go, as the days, as you say, get shorter and longer in winter and summer, so you do get that effect. Now, in Tromsø in northern Norway, they reckon maybe 25% of the population can actually suffer from this. What they tend to develop in these countries is social mechanisms to try and counter the effects of it. In other places, there's even a genetic effect. For example, in Iceland, they tend not to suffer from it. And there's been studies in America, in northern states like Minnesota and also in Canada, where there were quite a lot of people of Icelandic extraction. They find that people there, and it gets pretty dark in winter there in northern Minnesota and, as I said, in southern Canada, they found that people there who have got Icelandic antecedents suffer less from seasonal affective disorder than people whose parents came from southern countries or grandparents came from southern countries where it's not so much of a problem, because the closer you move to the equator, so you move to the 12-hour day, 12-hour night, right the way through the year. So, yes, it does have an effect. A lot of them, as I said, have developed almost cultural traditions as a way to try and get over that actual biological effect that's going on.
But so what you're saying there is it's a kind of an adaptive trait among some populations.
Right.
So
right.
It's evolved over time, is that it?
Yeah, and if you think about it, Iceland, for example, is a really tough place to live. And it's no good saying on a Tuesday, oh, I really don't feel like it today. That's not good enough in a place like as Iceland was, you know, over the last thousand. Iceland's been colonized. I think the Danes first went there, as far as we understand, for about 1,200 odd years. And as I said, to survive in somewhere like Iceland, you couldn't actually be under the weather, as we would call it. And so the ones who survived, the ones were the ones who adapted.
What's your own view on light therapy? Do you think staring into a lamp, a big bright lamp, can help with seasonal affective disorder? Do you think it actually works?
Yeah, it certainly seems to work for a large number of people. And it's a difficult one to test because it's very hard to trial it. Because what do you use as your control? You know, you're looking at a bright light. Very hard to substitute something for that, and obviously not let the person know that they're doing something different. So it's been extraordinarily difficult to actually do what we would normally consider, you know, a random controlled trial. On the other hand, there's an awful lot of evidence that, yes, in quite a large percentage of cases, it does have a helpful effect. There are all sorts of things going on with sleep and light and mental conditions. For example, one of the ways of dealing with depression, if you're sleep deprived, if somebody who's depressed, clinically depressed, doesn't have a night's sleep, they will feel, in the main, they will feel much better the following day. Much better. The problem is that the effect doesn't last because the second night they'll sleep and they'll wake up and they'll be clinically depressed again. So there are things going on with our brain that we still, you know, are a long, 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 long way from understanding. But in answer to the question, yes, I would say that looking into a bright light during the winter for about an hour a day will probably help.
Presumably on the flip side of that, though, Leon, that if you are a worker who's in a factory doing the late night shift or the overnight shift or a nurse or wherever you're working from, that artificial light has a big impact on your brain and long-term health. So do you think there's an argument to say that, let's say, company managers and directors or are company owners, that they are required in some way to better screen for health problems of employees that work these late night shifts that are under artificial light all day? Like, I know in the offices here, we're surrounded by windows, so we have natural light as well as artificial light. But I imagine if you're down in a basement somewhere over the long term, or that bright artificial light at night, that really kicks into you.
Even if you've got some natural windows and natural light, the light doesn't get that far into the room, actually. You're still basically dealing with a light regime, which is maybe about what would be called 500 lux, which is still pretty low. But come into the night shift. If you work nights for 20 years, you still don't adjust in the main. 98% of shift workers do not adjust. Their body clock is still operating as though they should be up during the day, asleep during the night. A consequence of this long-term effect are things like higher incidence of diabetes, of cardiovascular disease, strokes, gastrointestinal diseases, and also some mental health problems. And also, there's been some results which suggest that it affects cognition, the ability to process information. All these things are now relatively well defined. Difficult one, because it's all done by observation. The studies are all, yes, we'll look at night shift workers, yes, we'll look at some day shift workers, and we'll measure various things and see what's going on. But there's difficult to get to a mechanism with humans, because you can't put humans in controlled conditions like that. It's not very ethical if you know it, there may be damaging effects. So it's never been done in a controlled trial for any length of time. But we are beginning to understand what's going on. And there definitely seem to be health problems associated with long shift working patterns, are also inappropriate shift working patterns. You know, swing shifts of changing from one to another fairly rapidly, week in, week out.
Is there any research out there on climate change and how it challenges our circadian clock?
Well, think about a bird that migrates from Northern Europe down to Central Africa. It leaves in the summer when the days are beginning to shorten, and it knows it's got an internal timing mechanism via the circadian rhythms. It can measure the day length or the night length, right? So in the autumn, it knows the days are starting to shorten or the nights are starting to lengthen. Time to go. Off it goes. It gets down to the Congo near the equator. How does it know when to come back? Because it's 12-hour days, 12-hour nights. They don't change. It can't measure anything. What a lot of them have, these birds, is an internal clock which strikes, for want of a better word, once a year. And when it strikes, it says, okay, time to go back, because it's early spring. And off they fly and they get back to Northern Europe. Now, the problem is if the climate, that's all geared to, they get back to Northern Europe, they get back to where the trees are, just in time, the leaves are just starting to bud, and so they're crawling with caterpillars. But it's all happening a few weeks earlier in Northern Europe now than it used to. So the birds are coming, but a lot of the caterpillars are already gone. That's what's happening. I mean, they measured this and they've timed this. And that's happening all over the animal kingdom. Plants have got a problem because plants can't move, because one solution is that, you know, you move a bit, but the plants can't do that. So what we're going to see if climate change really kicks in the way it does is not just, you know, flooding of lowland areas and all that sort of thing, but we're going to see major changes in the plant population. And, of course, if that happens, you then get major changes in the animal population that live on the plants. Effectively, their habitat has gone.
You have some very interesting stuff on circadian blindness and how the different light signals that the eye can see.
Yes, this was discovered with some blind people. They obviously have got no visual sense. But what it was discovered was that they can distinguish, not all of them, it depends on the condition, they could distinguish light. And what it was discovered was that we're all probably relatively familiar with rods and cones in the eyes, and these are the way in which we receive the light signal, and then it's processed and turns into a nerve signal and goes into the visual cortex, and we see what we're looking at. But this is about vision. Rods and cones are about vision. What they discovered was that circadian reception relied on a completely different receptor. And that receptor was sensitive not to the actual light that it was seeing, in a sense, but the illuminance level, because that told you if it was dawn or not. Because as the day got brighter, so the light got brighter. And that's what you needed to set your circadian clock. You didn't need to see it. You just need to be able to sense that there was a change in the light levels. And they've discovered this and worked on it and have teased out in the retina of the eye about 1% of the cells are these melanopsin cells that actually are the ones that receive the light signal and transmit that via a nerve fiber to a special tiny bunch of cells, about 10,000 cells, about 2 centimeters in from the middle of your forehead, from where your eyebrows would meet, and that's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and that's where, if you like, the fundamental rhythm emanates from. And because it's linked to this light signal, so it's reset every 24 hours to the solar cycle, so it's always giving you a rhythm of about 24 hours. If you put a human being in constant conditions, say in a room where it's constantly light, and leave them for several days, then what happens is that the clock's natural rhythm is actually 24 hours and about 10 minutes in humans. So each day we're running at about 10 minutes slower. So over a period of 6 days, say a week, we're about an hour out compared to the actual time. But each day in the light, this is reset. So instead of losing those 10 minutes, it's reset to 24 hours each day. And that's the way it works. And that's the way it works for all other organisms as well. There are also other ways of training, if you like, the clock. One is through food, giving food at the same regular times. Yes, the body then sets itself up expecting that at those times. You can do it through various other things, such as exercise, depending if you do that. But you have to do it each day at the same time to actually entrain the clock.
Leon, does the body clock change as we age? Or let's say if we suffer from dementia, does it change things in any way?
Yeah, it changes as we age. First of all, it starts at about 4 months. Small babies don't have circadian rhythms. They feed constantly around the clock and all that sort of thing. They start to develop circadian rhythms at about 4 months of age. As you go through the teen years, as I said, teens tend to want to get up in the morning later and go to bed later, and then gradually it settles down into an adult pattern, and then as they get older, you get into older age, it starts to also deteriorate a bit. Partly it might be the light signals not getting through to the eye quite so effectively, cataracts and what have you. It could be that there's a problem with the processing in the suprachiasmatic nucleus that I mentioned, and it could be that there's a problem in that signal then getting out to the rest of the body. All these factors affect us. And what you get, the classic problem, is the educational world. Because, as I said, you get the youngsters, the students, the teenagers, who aren't that keen in the morning. They're not that with it in the morning. But you get their teachers, who tend to be older, who actually are better in the morning than they are in the afternoons. So you've got this ages established problem of the teachers are better in the morning, but the students are better in the afternoon.
It's always a problem in relationships, intimate relationships as well, because you may be very driven in the morning, let's say, and some people are a bit more interested at night, and it can have a big impact on sexual relationships, can't it?
Yeah, there was a famous researcher in this area who, he was a night person, a serious night person, and his wife was a serious morning person. And he used to say they used to meet for breakfast. Yes, I mean, it can have serious effects on, I mean, sexual relations. Obviously, the social factors are important as to what time you can do it. It tends to be a maximum of about, roughly about 11, 12 o'clock at night. But that's normally because that's when people go to, you know, go to bed. The best time probably is relatively early in the morning in terms of your arrhythmic activity, but there's all sorts of reasons. People got to go to work and all that sort of thing. But yes, if you've got a morning person who's married to a night person and they've got very, very different, if you like, time schedules, that can be quite tricky to manage.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, have you ever taken melatonin after a long-haul flight, and what's your own view on it?
I don't, but quite a few of my, you know, friends and colleagues, they have. It's never been properly trialled, so whether or not it has deleterious side effects is not really known. It's a prescription medication in the UK, but you can get it over the counter in the States and in various other countries. And so quite a few, as I said, researchers in this field have taken it, but I've got to add a cautionary note to that. If you go to a scientific conference, even these days, you will find people, eminent scientists who know an awful lot about everything, will still be smoking. So quite whether or not to accept their judgments on health matters, I'm not sure. But it works for some people. It doesn't work for others. It's a peculiar sort of hormone. Its actual mechanisms are beginning to be understood. It's probably better if you've got a problem with jet lag, and it does affect you. As I say, it doesn't affect everybody. The problem is that you have to try and readjust to the time zone that you've moved to as quickly as possible. And one way of doing that is by this light signal. And so a pair of sunglasses are one of the best medications, because it depends on how many time zones you've crossed, and it does depend whether you're going east to west or west to east. But you might want to shift your clock forward or shift your clock back. And the way you'll do that is you will either try to seek out light, you won't wear sunglasses, or you'll try and hide from light, you will wear sunglasses. So it's what you do when you get off the plane with your pair of sunglasses in your pocket, and you have to know what you're supposed to be doing. And I'm afraid for that, you're going to have to just look at one of our books where we do explain this and give you a schedule, what to do if you're going 6 time zones east or 8 time zones west or whatever it is, and leaving in the morning or leaving in the evening and so on. But if you look at that, that's probably an effective mechanism of trying to ameliorate jet lag effects.
So with a bit of information, you can override the system, if you will. I'm just wondering, what hasn't been figured out yet? Or what is there left for you to figure out with circadian rhythms?
What's left to figure out?
Yeah.
Well, what we're beginning to be understood is the linkage between this rhythmic activity and all various other parts, particularly of the brain. There are direct linkages between the suprachiasmatic nucleus and bits of the brain, and there are also chemical linkages. And they all work and are timed, and they work together. And we're beginning to understand the connections. So we're beginning to understand the relationship between sleep and these rhythms. We're beginning to understand mental dysfunctions and these rhythms and sleep patterns. And they all sort of work together. And if one bit starts to break down, it can have serious effects in other bits of the system. So we've got to think of systems and networks now. And that's really quite difficult to get one's head around and to try and understand a complete network or a complete system. But that's the way a lot of biology is now going. that it's beginning to appreciate the fact that you've got all these different chemicals, all these different molecules all there, all being switched on and being switched off by enzymes at different times, and all these enzymes are being switched on and switched off by rhythmic functions. And if it's all working in actual harmony, we feel fine. But it's terribly easy for something somewhere to go wrong and then have these big knock-on effects. That's what they're trying to sort of tease out at the moment and understand. And that's a big ask, because the brain is horribly complex. But that's the next 50 years. Chronobiology, as it's called, it's only about 60-odd years old as a real scientific discipline. And it's come an awful long way, like all other scientific disciplines have in the last 60 years. The next 60 years are probably going to be just as interesting as they begin, as I said, to uncover how these networks and systems really function.
Last question for you, Leon. What's your take on lunar cycles and how they affect human behaviour, whether it's our sleep patterns, digestion, our sense of mojo or creativity? Do you believe in the idea that the full moon can kind of kick into our system in some way and have either a detrimental or a very proactive effect on us?
There's no evidence whatsoever for the moon, for lunar cycles. None whatsoever. It's one of these myths that is around. It's probably because of, you know, the female menstrual cycle is about 28 days, and lots of associations were made. But when some people have looked and tried to look for evidence, like, are there more murders on when there's a full moon? Or, are all these sorts of things happening? And there's no evidence to associate anything with the lunar cycle.
Remarkable when you think about the public obsession and cultural obsessions, whether it's in literature or music or whatever, on full moons, isn't it?
It is. And, the moon is pretty fascinating. And when you look at it, you do see the change. You get, in a lot of cultures, each month there's a different name for the moon, the harvest moon, a hunter's moon, and all that sort of aspect. And it is incredibly important in a cultural sense, and that is the way people have done it. But in a biological sense, no.
That was author, biologist and broadcaster Dr. Leon Kreitzman. Circadian Rhythms, A Very Short Introduction is written by Leon Kreitzman and Russell F. Foster and retails for in or around €11 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the cautionary words of Leon Kreitzman and Russell F. Foster, who write in their conclusions to Circadian Rhythms. The profound changes in light, temperature and food availability in nature are all masked by our 24/7 society. With such ancient biological systems embedded within our biology, we are going to have to learn much more about how circadian systems work, develop and control physiology and behaviour if we are to achieve health and productivity in our brave new 24/7 world. Thought-provoking words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.